This podcast may contain language that's not appropriate for all listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Today we're doing Working Girl. So if you haven't seen it, it's a little bit past the deadline there because it was in 1988. And you don't want us to ruin it for you, you might want to pass on this one. And we will see you next time.
Are you ready for one dry kiss? Come the New Jerusalem.
Welcome to One Dry Kiss, our cussy irreverent love letter to rom-coms, where we recap one Growing Pains movie in the month of September. And today I am channeling my inner Hair Bear because we are doing Working Girl. I am here with the, just a second.
You don't know who you're sitting here with? Is that
no,
what you're saying?
I am here with the test to my sin, Miss Tamara Cosio.
Aha. Okay. And I am here with the dippity to my do, the aqua to my net, the extra to my super hold. Hairspray, that is. Because she sticks by me no matter what. Yay. Corinne Edding. Well, you reached real, real far back to get this one, Corinne.
Oh.
Working Girl with Melanie Griffith.
Yes. Well, you know, it was a movie that I loved back in the day. Mm. And I got to tell you, watching it again, it held up for me. And the hair was glorious.
I don't think I saw this movie before last week. For the podcast, I don't think I ever watched it.
What?
Before.
Wow.
Yeah. I know. I was very surprised myself. But, you know, it makes sense because I grew up with my father. Uh-huh. And he was not going to the video store and being like, Working Girl, yes, that looks like the great movie to watch on Friday night with my girls.
He's getting you like the female empowerment series. You're doing 9 to 5 double feature and Working Girl together. I can see it now.
No. No, he was doing like Zombie Stab 3 and the Five Faces of Death. Don't know why I still have nightmares. Totally fine. Totally fine.
Oh, that would give me nightmares too. But you know, then again, I got nightmares from Pee Wee Herman. So I was lily livered in comparison to you.
Yeah.
You have a toughness that I just don't have.
Well, it comes from watching that shit at a very young, tender age. But I do remember vividly that my dad was dating this woman for a very short period of time. I only remember her being at our house once. And she had a couple of girls that were around me and my sister's age, not much younger or older. Mm-hmm. And I think to impress her, we wanted to see Purple Rain with Prince.
Wow.
We were all Prince fans. Uh-huh. And so we rented Purple Rain and all proceeded to sit around the living room and watch it. And it was very uncomfortable in a lot of places.
Uh-huh.
And I remember my 10-year-old self would like look at the screen and see all the things that they were doing that I was like, oh, that's not right. And then I like look over at my dad at his date and I'm like, oh my God, are you seeing this? You are, aren't you? You're letting us watch this? Oh, my God.
Well, you know, Purple Rain, I saw that in my, late teens. And I was excited. Mm-hmm. I was, thinking Grease, but with...
No.
Prince. And so I'm sitting down, and it was, another Rocky experience where I was like, oh, shit. He abused that... Okay. This is supposed to be, this was not what I signed up for, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, I hate to say it, but I had a couple of those moments in Working Girl. I was like, oh yeah, feel good, what the fuck? Seriously? Seriously?
I can't wait. Oh, the boobies, 80s movies, they loved showing the boobies in the 80s movies.
Oh yeah. Oh, we got some time to kill and some space to fill. Throw a titty out there,
yeah.
Or two.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do have to say that I kind of came up with a theory that I was debating on whether I wanted to bring it up earlier after when we were doing the Dry Kiss ratings, but I think I'll say it now that Melanie Griffith kind of strikes me as like the Kardashian of the 80s because Ooh. Her acting is very even kiltered and not super like overt. So there were some moments in the movie where I was like, what's happening? Oh, she's upset. Okay, I couldn't tell. Oh, she's feeling something. I couldn't tell. Okay.
Oh, I'm excited to get into this. Do you have a synopsis for us?
Yes, even though you didn't write it down for me to do.
I'm sorry.
You just wrote synopsis. And then I was like, wait, is that me or that you? Is that she writes something clever down.
I do.
And now I feel a little betrayed. I feel neglected. So you do like Tamara to write the synopsis with like extra letters in there. But not today.
Hey, when did I get you this script?
I
got it to you on Wednesday of last week.
Which is plenty of time to write something clever, a loving, clever note for your bestie to remind her to do the synopsis.
I was pushing it out. I was in labor, but it had to be like abbreviated. I was in abbreviated labor, so something slipped through the cracks.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Oh,
that's okay. I just wrote in crayon on my computer screen.
Great. Thank
screen
you.
Doesn't love you.
Oh! Yes, gentle listeners, it's true. You found out the real truth behind the matter. I have issues with Tamara, and I let it all hang out by not writing a clever thing asking her to do the synopsis.
We're frenemies. Frenemies! All right, well, I'll hold it against you up until the end of this episode.
Thank
then.
You. I appreciate that.
No problem. Synopsis that thankfully I realized I had to write even though there was not a reminder written there for me. Tess, played by Melanie Griffith, is a small-time gal trying to make it big in the finance world, but she constantly gets overlooked because she doesn't have the right connections or Ivy League education. Until one day, she lands a job with Catherine Parker, played by Sigourney Weaver, a poised, confident financier, because I don't know what the hell she did exactly, who takes Tess under her wing. Tess thinks she's found the mentor of her dreams until Catherine has a ski accident out of the country. And while Tess house sits, I say that with serious air quotes, she discovers that Catherine has taken one of Tess's great ideas and is toting it as her own. Tess, no longer willing to sit by the wayside and be passed over, takes her boss's place and maneuvers meetings to make her idea a reality.
Yes.
Tess's first notable meeting is with Jack Traynor, played by Harrison Ford, who makes mergers with Tess in the boardrooms.
Wombs? Oh.
In the boardrooms and eventually, bonk chicka bow now, in the bedrooms.
Oh.
But things get sticky when Catherine comes back and realizes Tess's plot. And did I forget to mention that Catherine thinks that Jack Traynor is her boyfriend?
Uh-oh.
Nope. So when Catherine gets back home, the shit and the Aquanet hit the fan. Can Tess use her street smarts and real smarts to pull through and prove she's a partner worth working with? Will Catherine and Jack partner up and squeeze Tess out of this big deal? Find out with us as we don our high hair, green eyeshadow, Reebok high tops and join rank with the working girl.
Yay! That was fantastic. You did a great job.
Thank you. I felt like I was stumbling all over the place with my pronunciation.
No, you were fantastic.
Thank you. And Corinne, I think it's time to punch that clock. Are you ready to introduce us to the working girl?
Oh, I am so ready. I got my shoulder padded business suit on and I'm pumped up and an empowered woman.
I do have to say one thing before we get started is that this was on Prime Video right when we decided to do this movie and then got yoinked off.
Right.
So I watched it for the first time and I wanted to go back and do like bad makeup and big hair watch and like make a notation of all the fashion flaws and faux pas, but I wasn't able to.
No!
Very disappointing because I wanted to point out Joan Cusack's wicked green eyeshadow look that I was just like, what in the ever-loving hell is going on here?
Well, you can see a still of it on IMDb, so There's still time.
Oh, no. She had quite a few.
Yes.
Eyeshadow looks. There was the multicolor. There was the tricolor. And then there was the singular color one. And the singular color one was really what intrigued me because she almost looked like a clown.
Oh, so good. Well, the singular colored one is the one that is still on the trailer for Working Girl. And apologies to that because, yeah, as I was finishing up the script on Wednesday, I saw the thing that said, you have 3 days left on this video. And I was like, no.
Yeah. And I knew that. You told me that, which is why I watched it. But then I was like, oh, they're lying. It's still going to be on there.
Well, and sometimes they do that. They're like, it's going to expire. Mm-hmm. It is. And then it reappears. They
extend it. Yeah. They're just dangling the carrot in front of you saying, jump, jump.
I am donning my big shoulder padded power suit, my big hair, and I am empowered by let the river run, let all the dreamers wake the nation. See it, Carly. Come the new Jerusalem.
Take it home, Corinne.
We'll probably get a cease and desist for my singing throughout this movie because they do not actually have, like, you can see, if you don't want to watch the movie, but you want to watch the movie, you can watch the almost the entire movie in the music video for Let the River Run. And
okay.
Yeah.
And who sings that?
Carly Simon.
Got it.
But if you look on Spotify, they just have bad covers of it. They don't. There's like Carly Simon versions of it, but they're not like the rockin' version that is the empowering version, the version that makes you want to put on your shoulder padded power suit. No, they're just like pretty and soft. And we're like, no, we need the power. The power.
Like Carly Simon karaoke versions.
Yeah. Yeah. So that song plays as we see beautiful pans of the Statue of Liberty, and I think of Tamara and I visiting New York and Tamara being in a Marilyn Monroe poncho that was blowing all up around her when we went to said Statue of Liberty. We see.
That's what happens when you put a Californian on the fucking ferry in October.
It was glorious. I have pictures. I'm planning on giving her a flip book for Christmas, gentle listeners. Don't let Tamara know.
No, don't. Thank you. That memory is seared into my head forever and always. I do not need a gentle reminder of it. Thank you, though.
You were awesome. We see a ferry making its way towards New York City, and the Twin Towers are still standing. It's 1988, and Roxette's Listen to Your Heart, the Beach Boys, Kokomo, come on, we'll get there and we'll take it slow, and Poison's Nothing But a Good Time, which Tamara knows.
You really want to guess how many cease and desist letters in this episode?
50!
Don't need nothing but a good time. How can I resist? Ain't looking for nothing but a good time. And it don't get better than this.
Ooh, damn, you brought it. All those songs ruled the airways and big hair ruled the fashion scene. Like magnificently big hair. On the ferry, we see the big hair, but we don't hear any of those songs because Sin, played by the woman, the myth, the legend, Joan Cusack, is singing Happy Birthday to her bestie, Tess, played by Melanie Griffith. Sin holds up a hostess cupcake with 3 lit candles for Tess to blow out and make a wish. They get off the ferry and start walking towards their respective jobs before Tess and Sin part ways. Tess says, no lunch, I got speech class. Sin rolls her eyes. What do you need speech class for? You talk fine. Tess continues, and I've got emerging market seminar at 5:30. Sin pushes back. It's your birthday. Can't the markets emerge without you this once? Tess knows there's something afoot and asks, what time is my surprise party? Sin tries to act innocent, but finally tells her that they're expecting her back home at 7. So Tess compromises. I'll leave early and be home by 7:15. They playfully push into each other like the besties that they are before heading off to their different jobs.
I have some issues with Sin later on in the movie that makes me question her best friend motives, but I will save them for that time.
I think I may have a suspicion as to...
I bet you do. I'm sure you know exactly what I'm talking about. So I'm like, are you fucking kidding me, Sin? Are you fucking kidding me? We're not even there and I'm already heated about it. Oh my God. We gotta save it. Ugh. Anyways... Tess works at a stock trading company as a secretary. Everyone knows her and seems to like her. And as soon as she gets to her desk, she starts swapping out her sneakers for heels. The phone rings and Tamara has to jump in here and say, "Ah, it's only been a short 8 years since 9 to 5 was made, and women have already figured out the shoe swap in office."
Ooh, yeah, good point.
Gentle listeners, 9 to 5 was a movie we did not too long ago, and at the beginning intro of the movie, they showed tons and tons of women in Chicago?
Chicago, yeah.
On the Chicago streets, darting back and forth, all in heels. Mm-hmm. And I was like, why aren't they wearing sneakers until they get into the office? Because they didn't know you then. They were barely let into the workforce. But here we are, Amir, 8 years later, and... they finally caught on. More comfortable wearing the sneakers in and changing out under your desk when you get there. Anywho.
Unless you're wearing looks like a heel, feels like a sneaker. Easy.
Oh, yes. You sound like a commercial. On the phone is an investor demanding to talk to her boss, Mr. Turkle. But Mr. Turkle is camped out in the bathroom. If you know what I mean, Corinne writes that, but it being 88 and in a stockbroker's office, I feel like I need to clarify that he's not doing lines of coke, he's taking a shit.
Yeah.
Tess makes her way to the men's room, uncomfortably hovers by the door, and lets Mr. Turkle know that his client is stressing out about the Danicich, a stock she told her boss to go short on. But Tess says he doesn't want to hear it from a secretary. A guy rushes out past Tess, who is trying to be as unobtrusive as possible, and Mr. Turkle relents, but not before making Tess hand him a roll of toilet paper. At the end of the day, her boss Turkle lets her know that they turned Tess down for the entree program again. Turkle and his coworker Lutz insist that they did everything they could, but she's up against Harvard grads, and what does she have? Ugh, a little bit of night school?
Fuckers.
Meanwhile, yeah, fuckers. She's giving them all... the info on good trades and makes them so much money, but they do not value her. So, suck it, boys. However, Turkle has good news for her. Lutz has a friend who wants to meet her for drinks. His name is Bob. He works in arbitrage. And Corinne so graciously adds, "What's arbitrage, you may ask? The act of buying a security in one market and simultaneously selling it in another market at a higher price." Thanks, Google Machine, and it sounds like a shitty, stressful job. If you work in arbitrage, please tell us what you like about it. I don't want to defame your job. Gee, the more you know. They insist that Bob from arbitrage is not trying to get into her pants. It's a legit job opportunity where she can be his new assistant. He's just waiting for her call, extension 256. As the guys start heading out the door, the other secretaries gather around singing happy birthday to Tess and bring her a bouquet of balloons. Her two bosses quickly say, "Oh, it's your birthday? You should have told us," and quickly hustle out the door. Fuckers.
Seriously, fuckers. This next section is entitled Surprise Party and Not a Surprise. Bob from Arbitrage is a dick. Spoiler alert. That evening, when Tess gets home, she creeps around her house looking for the surprise, but gives up after not finding a soul. She opens the bathroom door and, surprise! Let's hope she didn't pee herself, as there are at least 8 people hanging out in her small bathroom.
Oh my gosh, I don't know if I've told my surprise peeing story on this podcast, but it feels like it's time.
Oh, I can't wait.
When I lived in San Jose and was going to high school, for some inexplicable reason, I did not want to use the school's restrooms. I would hold it all goddamn day. Ooh. Until I got home, and my walk was a good 35 to 40 minutes from my high school. So one day, I was really, really pushing it, and I ran into my house like latchkey kid. Nobody was supposed to be there. But my sister sometimes had friends that would need to hide out, not for bad ways, but just like needed a place to hang during the day to get away from whatever they were. And she would help them out. And so her one friend, I think her name was Olga, was over this day. And she heard me coming in and thought I was my dad. Oh, so no. She hid in the bathroom behind the bathroom door. And so I like fly in to go pee. And then she sees me and she goes, "Oh, it's you." And I turn around and I was like, ah, not expecting her to be there because nobody was supposed to be home.
Right.
Peed all over myself.
Oh, and I think that's what must have happened to Tess. You two are so twinsies. Oh my gosh.
I was going to say, well, if Kristen Caruso can tell her truth on Let's Go to Court about shitting in a Bed Bath & Beyond bag in a car, I can tell my truth about peeing in my own bathroom when I was scared by my sister's friends who was hiding out in our place.
I would have peed myself too. So I think that you were just on the right track with that.
Ooh, thank you.
And let's talk about high school bathrooms. People smoking in them. People using copious amounts of hairspray. They are funky as hell. Not interested. Apparently she has better bladder control than both Tamara and I do, but
It's yet to be seen.
Yeah, we don't see the party, but she seems to have pretty good friends, except as we find out after the party, her boyfriend, played by Alec Baldwin, is a dick. He bought her lingerie, which he insisted she try on that night, and she's not thrilled about it, but obliges him. And throughout this movie, apparently he's bought her a lot of lingerie because that is exclusively what she wears. And I'm just like, okay, you go, girl.
And she even says, "I wish you would buy me something I could wear outside the house."
Mm-hmm. Later, we see her riding in the back of a town car with Bob from Arbitrage, who is snorting coke, popping champagne, spraying her with it as an excuse to feel her up, to dry her off.
And who is played by Kevin Spacey. Oh!
Well, so Perv plays Perv. It's kind of perfect.
Yes. I was going to say, oh my gosh, was that a casting choice to behold?
Mm-hmm. So, a little too on the nose, sadly. Surprisingly, she's not playing into his little games. He tells her, "Oh, I'll put on a video that we give to the colleges about arbitrage, and if you have any questions, please just ask." He turns on the TV, and the TV is super tiny because it's the 80s, but, you know, he turns on the TV, pressing play on the videotape, and it's a porn. Things that I cannot unsee.
Oh.
He apologizes, assuring her that he'll switch out the tapes unless she wants to keep on watching. Tess warily eyes him. "Bob, I'm hungry, but I'm not that hungry. Are you even looking for an assistant?" Bob puts on his mysterious face and says, "Well, not right now, but we will have other opportunities happening. We can discuss it back at the hotel." Tess asks, "Hotel?" He assures her, "Oh yeah, the company has a suite that they let us high performers use when it's not hosting clients." Tess shakes her head and says to the driver, "Let me out." She fucking sprays Bob down with champagne. Yay! And as soon as the town car stops, she hops onto the median in the pouring rain, getting big time splashed by cars passing by. But all of that was still better than being stuck in the car with that fucker, Bob. Back at work, Tess has had enough with her shitty male coworkers and types a message. This is such a Corinne move. And types a message to display on the stock ticker that scrolls through the trading room. David Lutz is a sleazoid pimp with a tiny little dick, and except I wouldn't say that part. Tiny little dick disclaimer, awesome people have tiny dicks too. Size does not equate skill or quality of human. Everyone in the room starts laughing at Lutz. Tess grabs her shit and walks the fuck out of the office, single-handedly quitting, getting fired, and becoming a legend in that office. I have burned it all down before, too.
Oh, God, it doesn't seem like that long ago because we were both alive during the 80s and just the fucking casting couch and the politics around that was just so, real and just fucked because that guy wasn't even, offering her a job. "I'll give you the prospect of potentially a job if you come back to the hotel with me."
Fucker.
Good Lord. Yeah. However, now that Tess doesn't have a job, she returns to her temp agency, and apparently this is the third time she's blown shit up in 6 months, Corinne. Have you blown shit up 3 times in 6 months? Are you that prolific at blowing shit up?
Not that prolific, but I've definitely done it on multiple occasions, just not within quite such a short proximity of time. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I, on the other hand, am scared to death about losing any of my jobs, so I will sit quietly and brood.
And I will say, fuck off. You, nope, I'm not putting up with your shit any longer. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, to be fair, you have been on your own for much longer, and you don't have the support system that I do, so...
Right. We have very different upbringings, and I have no sense or sort of security net to catch me if I decide I want to quit my job and lose my apartment. I could probably go live with a myriad of people, but I don't ever want to do that again.
Yeah. And while I definitely was not planning on in any of these situations on being unemployed for any extended period of time, I went and got another job right away. I knew that if I needed some kind of gap stop help from my parents that I could get it. So I had more freedom to be an ass and tell people to fuck off than you did.
Yes, because you could burn shit down and walk away. I could burn shit down and would more than likely be burning the fucking shit that I'm standing on and have no place to go from there. Singed with nothing left to show for it. Anyways, at the temp center, Tess is being helped by Olympia Dukakis, who is her temp agent, who lectures her saying this is the last time she can help her. Four strikes and you're out. However, she does have one last position for her. It's in mergers and acquisitions and starts Monday. Tess accepts the job and is back at the grind. The place she shows up to, though, is much nicer than the trading floor that she was working on before. Mm-hmm. She walks across the center of a large office that is filled with women all catching up and talking. Tess finds her desk and puts out some photos, books, and personal belongings and starts prepping for her day when suddenly silence falls over the office floor and all that is heard is a clickety-click of a typewriter key or Dolly Parton's nails, or a lone pair of heels approaching. All the secretaries look on in awe at Tess's very first boss lady. Her name is Catherine Parker, and she is played by Sigourney Weaver. Catherine's walking confidently past all their desks, and Tess learns that she will be her personal secretary. Introductions are made, and Tess realizes that they're essentially the same age, and she seems really quite lovely and way better than her previous bosses, mm-hmm. Lutz and Terkel.
Look.
Parker asks Tess to grab some coffee for the both of them. The both of them! And they can go over their work expectations. When Tess brings the coffee to Parker's corner office with windows, Catherine's finishing up a call and gives Tess the rundown. She seems tough, but transparent and fair. Be punctual and prepared. You're my connection to the outside world, so the way you are reflects on me. You're tough when wanted, accommodating when you can be, and never make a promise you can't keep. And I'm never on the other line. I'm in a meeting. Now, we're a team, and part of being on the team is having a uniform. Simple, elegant, impeccable. Dress shabbily, they'll notice the dress. Dress sharply, and they'll notice the woman. Coco Chanel. Tess was 100% on board with everything until they got to the attire section of the speech. She's filled with an oh shit feeling sitting across from Catherine because her boss is dressed in a beautifully fit blazer with a white silk scoop neck top, a slim gold necklace around her neck, and a skirt. She's likely wearing a skirt with her hair in a perfectly permed bob and just the peachiest glow of makeup on. In contrast, Tess is rocking a smoky eye, a nice bold red lip, giant hair, and is wearing a black turtleneck sweater dress, big gold hoop earrings, and several gold bracelets. Tess takes a breath, asking, "And how do I look?" Parker, who is now looking through her Rolodex, says, "You look great, but you may want to rethink your jewelry." And she goes on to emphasize, "Now remember, we're a team. I'm open to your ideas and look forward to working with you." And she thrusts her hands out for a handshake and smiles. "Call me Catherine." I, since I never saw this movie, had such high hopes for Catherine.
Yeah.
I was just like, oh.
I did too. And I also, I would have been like Tess shitting myself when she was putting a lot of emphasis on what you wear represents us and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I would have been sitting there like, fuck, fuck.
Yes, but in Tess's defense, if the 80s was a person, it would be a 12-year-old girl that just discovered makeup while simultaneously playing dress-up in her really cool aunt's closet. Because back then, it was all about colors, all the makeup, all the things, all the accessories all at once. It was about excess and it was about the more, the better.
Yes.
So Tess was very much in style.
Yes.
With how she was dressing and her clothing and makeup and jewelry and all that. But, you know, Catherine was just more demure and understated.
Yes. There is definitely a cultural difference between them. And I also, like I said, if I was like dressed in what I would wear to an office now and she gave that speech, I'd just be like, gulp. How am I dressed? ? Hiding behind my hands.
And I'd be sitting there going, is there a wardrobe allowance? Are we allocating some money for work clothes? Because I could go shopping.
But yeah, I also had hopes for Catherine. And I too would want to impress my first female boss as well. Because,
yeah.
And she's like talking this great talk. We're a team.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like halfway through going, I don't know this movie super well, but I thought Sigourney Weaver was like the bad guy, but maybe I was wrong because I didn't even watch the trailer. So I must be remembering it incorrectly as Corinne giggles diabolically. Just wait. Just wait.
Immediately after her meeting with Catherine, Tess goes to the bathroom and quickly shucks off her jangly bracelets. Later that day, she's called into another meeting with Jenny, another high-ranking female coworker. Catherine is throwing a party since she's new to the area from Boston and wants to create connections. Jenny is giving all the hippest places to go, but when Catherine is about to wrap things up, Tess speaks up saying that she read in W Magazine that dim sum is supposed to be the upcoming trend. You know those little dumplings? And that she knows a place to get them. Catherine is thrilled, and Jenny offers up some shade, saying, well, I didn't figure you for a reader of W. Tess responds, I read all kinds of things. I never know where the next big idea is coming from. Jenny eyes her sharply as she gets up from her seat. If dumplings could be considered the next big idea. And heads out the door. Catherine thanks Tess for her contribution and encourages her to keep on speaking up.
Oh my goodness, dumplings. Have you ever had dumplings at the place where they wheel the carts around and then you could just look at them and be like, you want this kind? Yes, please give me a plate of those. Uh-huh. And a plate of those and a plate of those.
Yeah.
I went to a dumpling place in Chinatown in downtown LA and fucked around and accidentally spent $175 because I kept pointing at stuff and wasn't paying attention to all the stuff that I bought. So I essentially came home with two bags of leftovers and a $176 bill.
Well, you know, I mean, dumplings keep. You can freeze them. Perfect. You had a few meals out of it, I hope.
Oh, yeah. Just note to self, we're just going to have to go out to eat with each other.
We're compatible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You order some dumplings, I'm going to eat the fucking dumplings.
Seriously.
Get some edamame. I'm in there with you, girl.
Yes.
I'm all in on the edamame.
Tessa's victory is short-lived when she finds herself at Catherine's party rolling around a giant steam cart of dumplings. Obviously, she did not take Jenny's suggestion of hiring servers.
Hmm.
Which, to be fair about the dumplings, everyone loves, but she's getting hit in the face with steam and looks a hot mess, literally. At this party, beyond the fact that she should have hired some servers, two things become quite apparent to Tess. One, her boss is a badass bitch. She sees Catherine holding court in the center of the room in a floor-length red dress, artfully handling a smarmy guy who is hitting on her and turning it into a potential business transaction with the promise of meeting her for a drink if he comes through. And I was like, damn, she turned that shit around in a way that I would have just been too pissed off to do.
It's so commonplace. Like the 80s was an HR nightmare.
Oh,
this day and age.
For real.
So many violations and harassment suits. I'm like, oh my God, the millions of dollars she could get if she just like was working two or three decades later.
Mm-hmm. Catherine says, I never burn a bridge. Today's junior prick is tomorrow's senior partner. And Tess also learns, too, that Catherine may talk about them being a team, but Tess was quickly put in her place when Catherine told her to take another lap round the party with the steam cart and offhandedly says, I would totally help you, but the quarterback can't be passing out Gatorade, fucker. This is when you see, I think there's something a little off here about Miss Catherine.
I mean, it's the 80s and she's trying to make an impression for all these big ball guys. So I doubt she would want to be rolling around a steam cart like Susie Homemaker.
Absolutely. But I completely agree with you. I don't think that she should be rolling a steam cart. I don't think that fucking Tess should be rolling around a steam cart either. But when she makes a comment of, I totally would help you, but the quarterback can't be passing out Gatorade. Oh, Tam, I would totally help you, but I'm just too valuable. I'm sorry.
Well, she is Catherine Parker after all. Next, we see Tess after she's been working with Catherine for a while. And here's where we find out that Catherine fucking smokes in her office. What the hell? I mean, here's where we find out that Catherine might be interested in some of Tess's ideas. Okay, Catherine may smoke in her office, but Sigourney Weaver doesn't because she barely pulls on that cigarette in this scene. Just saying. Tess comes in as she's been following Trask Industries. She knows that they're interested in buying TV stations, but Tess explains, I think they should buy into radio. It's an easier entry point. There are more for sale, and it takes care of their worry about being bought by the Japanese, as the FCC doesn't allow foreign ownership of radio or TV stations. As she makes sure it's Tess's original idea, and she's told no one, Catherine says she'll look over her notes and think about it. Tess latches onto this bit of hope and says softly, so I've been trying to get into the entree program? And Catherine cuts her off. Absolutely, two-way street, remember? She leaves the office feeling more hopeful than before when she was carting around a steaming dim sum cart, and Catherine immediately looks into Trask Industries. Tess goes home and excitedly tells her beau about the prospect of working with someone who believes she has potential. And he can't relate because he's a guy and it's the 80s and he's a completely dismissive dick about the whole thing.
Aww.
A.K.A. Mick.
Yeah. Nothing like having a supportive man in your life, right? Am I right?
Yeah. I don't understand, Tess, why you're so excited about working for a broad. Oh, I don't know, so I don't constantly get groped and harassed and my ass grabbed, looked over, stepped on, treated like a wife instead of a coworker.
You know, you could stay here with me, crank out some babies. I'll take care of you, Tess.
Oh, that sounds amazing, Mick. Yeah, let's do. No. No. I know, it's like so. We've come so far in so much time, but not enough's changed.
Yeah.
Like, watching movies like this makes me realize that. Yeah. It kind of gets me down a little bit. Because I'm like, Jesus Christ, it was what, 12 years prior to this movie that women couldn't even open up bank accounts without their father or husband or some man in their life vouching for them? I'm sorry, miss, you have a vagina. We can't open that savings account for you. When you bring a penis in, we'll talk.
I'm sorry, miss, you can't have a credit card or a loan because you need a man to help you with that.
Your menstruation cycle makes you too flighty and unpredictable.
I was wondering what my problem was. You have explained it all. Thanks, Tam.
Corinne, no, it's your ovaries, honey. We've discussed this.
Oh, right.
Yeah. That thing called a uterus in you makes you a hot mess.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Might as well just give up. Now, I'm just going to sit on my fainting couch and wait for a guy to come by and kiss me and take me away on their white horse.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As well you should. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Safest place for you, on a fainting couch waiting to be kissed. On another day, Catherine is getting ready for an Alps ski trip where she plans on getting engaged, whether he wants to or not. Thank you very much, because Catherine, it makes things happen. And while Tess is helping her clip giant red boots onto her feet, Catherine lets her know that the Trask Industries idea was a good one, but it turns out that Trask is only interested in TV. She encourages Tess, but keep on sharing those ideas with me. Mm-hmm. You never know what will pan out. Remember, we're a team. Tess tears up a bit And Catherine, who Tess considers a mentor, reminds her, asking Tess, who makes it happen? Tess is deflated and tearily says, I make it happen. Catherine prompts her again, who makes it happen? Tess more firmly states, I do. I make it happen. And Catherine affirms, that's right. Only then do we get what we deserve. Oh, Catherine, you will get what you deserve soon enough.
I'm like, thanks, Catherine, for mentoring Tess up to this point so that she knows that she needs to make it happen so she can get what she deserves.
Ugh, I've had a boss like this that will remain nameless, but I remember she would tell me such gems as, you know, I think if you lost some weight, we could be great friends.
Ew.
She didn't say that exactly, but she was talking about my weight and the things I could do to take steps to lose weight.
What?
And then at the end of the conversation, tacked on the, I think we could be great friends outside of work. And I'm like, so what you're saying is it's contingent on whether or not I look acceptable to you weight-wise? Fuck right off.
Seriously. And also illegal, like, to be talking to.
No, Corinne. She was just giving me health and fitness advice.
Oh.
Completely apropos of nothing.
Uh-huh.
And then reminding me that she thinks I am such a swell gal that we can be friends outside of work.
Well, you are a swell gal and I would love to be friends with you outside of work. I'm sorry I'm not going to give you weight loss advice, though.
Okay, well, we are friends outside of work, so let me just be clear on that.
Oh, good.
We've never actually worked together except for this podcast,
yes.
So I guess that counts.
Man, that fucker. She gets fucker title too.
Mm. I know. We've got way too many sad stories in this already. We got to cut some of this shit.
We move on to the next section, which I have entitled, Tess is a Big Ass Snoop. When Tam used the air quotes around house sitting, we find out a little bit of that right now. So, Catherine goes to the Alps, and what she made happen was not so much a proposal, but 2 weeks in a Swiss hospital with a broken leg. She calls up Tess and asks her to take care of things around the office and around her house. Because, you know, you need someone home to accept the flower delivery, after all.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. The imperative flower delivery.
Exactly.
Pip, pip.
Pip, pip. I always have flowers being delivered to my house.
No, you don't.
I don't. Flowers too high maintenance. They die. Then you have this vase full of crappy water and dead flower detritus all over the place. No. No, thank you. But Tess goes to Catherine's house and pokes around. She finds a cassette recorder where Catherine records memos to herself. Tess does her best single white female impression, listening to the tape and mimicking Catherine's speech so she can sound like her. She wanders around Catherine's spacious flat using her workout bike, which is also a scene in the Let the River Run video. We get to see her on the exercise bike. Yeah.
Because that's an integral plot point.
I know. Exactly. Ogling the high ceilings and crystal chandelier and sitting at Catherine's makeup table using her blush while Tess listens to the tape. As Tess fluffs some of Catherine's blush on her cheekbones, she hears Catherine's voice memo about contacting Jack Traynor, re the Trask Industries radio acquisition, and to specifically not go through Tess for this one. Tess shakes her fist at the ceiling, crying, curse your sudden but inevitable betrayal!
Because that was her idea, some bitch, that she said they weren't interested in because they only wanted TV, not radio.
Boo! Tess immediately hops over to Catherine's home computer and finds a future memo, which is artfully written. It's almost like that letter from the half of it. If you were only two of those things, I would still like you anyways. Dear Jack, there's a light bulb over my head. I know Trask and you know media, and that adds up to us finally doing a deal together. Let's run with it. Best, Catherine.
Oh, Lord. Had high hopes. Had really, really high hopes. Dashed all to hell now.
So much for an awesome female mentor.
Mm.
Tess goes home after this betrayal, only to pause a moment outside of the bedroom. She has a feeling, and she hopes she's wrong. She flings open the door. Bam! A very naked boyfriend has a very naked woman straddling him. Although he insists this is a simple misunderstanding, Tess has had enough and gets the fuck out of there.
So let's be very, very clear on this point, because it's going to come up later and I'm going to stomp it to death. Tess walks in on her boyfriend, Mick, sleeping with fucking is a better word, mm-hmm. another woman.
Oh, he wasn't fucking her. She was fucking him. So he is.
Right. She was on top. Yes. You're absolutely right. Yes. But
so he is faultless.
Right. Well, I mean, he didn't throw her off when she opened the door. He was like, wait, no, stop. But doesn't like physically remove the woman from his crotch and tells Tess that it's a misunderstanding. She fell and accidentally landed on my cock. I am so sorry. It happens all the time. She just slipped and fell over and over and over and over again.
We just happened to be naked because, you know, the thing was is that, you know, we were eating some food and then there was wine that got spilled on the both of us.
Right. Yeah. 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 And it's hot and the air conditioning's broke. So we just just stripped off our clothes and lo and behold, tripped and fell over and over again.
Over and over again. So, yeah, we're done here. She got the fuck out of there. Because shockingly, she did not believe her boyfriend when he said it was a misunderstanding. Huh.
I mean, who's she going to believe? Him or her lying eyes?
I even caught you on camera. Wasn't me.
With the girl on your parts. Wasn't me. She was straddling you in my bed. It wasn't me. I opened the door and saw you. Tess wanders around, not having really any place to go, and eventually winds up back at Catherine's place. Catherine's not going to need this place for a couple of weeks. And after some soul-searching, Tess realizes that she is tired of waiting for her bosses to realize she's hardworking and's got good ideas. Mm-hmm. She takes Catherine's advice and uses it to give herself a making it happen makeover. Complete with the 80s helmet head hairdo, business in front, and a braid in the back. In 1988, that was the height of restrained sophistication. Then she puts on a suit and arranges a meeting from Catherine's office with Jack Traynor for the next day at 10 a.m. She tells him that she's Tess McGill from Petty Marsh, who's the same company that Catherine works at, and they both work in mergers and acquisitions. She makes it out like she is Catherine's partner in business.
Yeah, so she technically lies about nothing at this point, and yet, lies of omission.
Lies of omission with helmet hair and a suit. Mm-hmm. Still not breaking any rules, technically.
She's making it happen.
Tess also declines some social invitations for Catherine, but sends Tess in her stead. Smooth. It's the closing party for Minadine, for the Minadine-Dalton merger. You know Minadine and Dalton, Corinne?
Oh,
you know the Minadine and Dalton merger?
Everybody knows Minadine and Dalton. You know they do the
88 Minadine and Dalton merger. But anyways.
Okay, fine. I won't tell you more about Minadine and Dalton because I'd just be insulting your intelligence. I get it.
Oh my gosh. That's why I wanted to watch this movie again, because I'm like, are they important? Do they come up later again?
No.
I don't think they do.
They don't.
Tess invites her bestie, Sin, to Catherine's house for company while she gets ready for the party. Sin calls her out on pretending to be someone she isn't as she applies Catherine's blush to her cheeks at Catherine's makeup table. Well, Sin, that is a pot calling the kettle black. And Tess brushes her off, explaining that she's just trying to manifest her destiny, and it's the perfect networking opportunity for her to meet Jack Traynor for the first time. She holds up dress after dress of Catherine's up to her body until she finds the one, a beautiful black sparkly number with the tag still on it. Sin turns around looking at her friend holding the dress up and shakes her head. It needs some bows or something. Tess disagrees. No, it's simple, elegant, and the sparkles say, I'm not afraid to be noticed. She hands the dress to Sin while she goes through Catherine's closet to find shoes. And Sin looks at the tag and balks, exclaiming, $6,000? It's not even leather! Which is, bless you, Corinne, $15,500 in today's money. A modest price for a dress that says it all, if you ask me. And I'm not asking you, but I'm very surprised you said that, Corinne.
Sarcasm.
I'm detecting notes of sarcasm in the parentheses. Yes, yes, there they are. Okay.
Seeing as how both of our cars aren't worth that much money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The most expensive pair of shoes I ever bought was $270, and I still have only wore them like once because they kill my feet, and I'm like, but I still have them. That is the extent of my luxurious clothing purchases. But Tess is not on the high level as you and I, Corinne, because she sees that dollar amount and starts to hyperventilate. Sin knows exactly what to do. She runs to Catherine's medicine cabinet, finds a giant bottle of Valium, and explains Riley the economy size and tells Tess to take one. Tess is dubious, but Sin says, don't worry, it'll just take the hair. Oh, sorry. It'll just take the edge off. And apparently it takes the edge off enough that Tess decides to have Sin cut her hair. What? She goes from having long hair that reaches the bottom of her shoulder blades to having an 80s bob that falls just below her ears. And of course, looks very much like a helmet. Aww, a very stylish helmet.
Very stylish helmet.
But in the 80s, if you didn't have a metric ton of hairspray in your hair, who were you even?
You were me and very unpopular. That's who you were.
I was going to say, when you're like, I'm channeling my high hair. And I'm like, you're high hair, Corinne. I think I've ever seen your hair high before in my life. Except maybe when you have your epic bedhead.
Yes. I've had some very high hair then.
Mm-hmm.
So Tess makes it to the event in the dress that costs almost as much as my car. Or costs more than my car probably at this point in time. And in a fur that I'm sure costs way more than that. She checks her coat and then sits at the bar trying to figure out what her in is at this social function. Fortunately, her target, who she has no idea what he looks like because the extent of cyberstalking she could do at that time was look up Jack Traynor on a database of who's who of business. Which most notably said he was divorced and worked in business, but did not include a bad digital picture.
Wah, wah, wah.
I know, they obviously needed tips from Andrew McCarthy in Pretty in Pink. Cyberstalking at that time was not as useful as it is now. But the reason she's there, Jack Traynor, approaches her at the bar, laying a hot, sexy compliment on her with absolutely no misogyny attached to it whatsoever.
Really? I'm dying to hear this. Dying.
He says, Tamara, he says, I've been looking for you. Oh, it gets better. Don't worry.
Do I know you?
That's what Tess says. And he replies, I promised myself that when I saw you, I would get to know you. You're the first woman I've seen at one of these things that dresses like a woman, not like a woman thinks a man would dress if he was a woman.
Yay. Well, he sounds awesome. Like, so glad you saddled up and sat next to me, Jack Traynor.
I would.
This is awesome. This is awesome. Screw those hard bitches that are wearing the power suits, right? Make slacks on a woman. Oh my God, that is so like 19. But I don't know what was in the 70s, that's for sure. Yeah.
Screw women for trying to like make it in a man's world in any way possible that they can make it. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. They just need to know their place and stay there, by golly.
Oh, I almost met up with this guy who he impromptu called me and was like, he was talking to me. It was fine and all until he said, impromptu of nothing, mind you. He starts going off on black women. He's black himself.
Wow.
He starts going off on black women and how they can't be trusted. And I am like very much along the lines of if Jack Traynor sat down in the bar and started talking this bullshit to me, I would have been like, I'm sorry, asshole. I got to go and hang out with some ladies now. Bye. I
was back away, back away, back away, back away, back away, back away, back away.
For real. I was like, dude, are you serious? If I'm going to choose between you and the ladies, I'm going to choose the ladies. And that is a whole lot of misogyny that I can't get behind. So sadly, we're not an item, Tam. Just letting you know.
Shocking.
And Jack might not have gotten very far with me at the bar. However, Tess smiles flattered because it was the 80s. And being told that she's not like the other women is, you know, a compliment. Mm. He asks her what she's doing here, and she explains that she's hoping to meet Jack Traynor. She's got a meeting with him tomorrow. She asks, do you know him? He responds, he just left. Tess replies, well, I should get going. But he pushes for her to stick around for a drink, insisting smoothly, no names, no resumes. Let's just get to know each other as people. Tess reluctantly agrees. Fine, but I'm buying. Jack smiles. It's an open bar. And Tess backpedals quickly. Well, I meant if it weren't open, I'd be buying. He nods. Sure, Jan. And orders tequila shots, which normally would be fine for Tess. She knows her way around a drink or two, thank you very much. But the fact that she took the Valium earlier magnified the power of the two shots she took, and before she knows it, she's looking at Jack with sparkly eyes and a sly smile, saying sultrily, I have a head for business and a body for sin. Is there anything wrong with that?
Oh my God. Oh my God.
I would be so embarrassed if I said that. Oh, Jack is floored. No, nothing wrong with that. She looks off to the side and sees her ex-boss man, Turkle, calling out to her from across the room. Tess, hey, Tess. She looks at Jack and says, I gotta go, and starts walking off, leaving her clutch purse behind. He picks it up and follows her. But as she gets closer to the coat check, she sees, Ginny from work. Boo! Ginny who's dressed like a man. I'm just saying. Not all feminine, like Tess.
Ginny who is dogging her dim sum idea. Fuck you, Ginny.
Yeah, no, seriously. Fuck you, Ginny. But nothing wrong with you dressing like a non-sexualized person. Tess hands Jack her coat check ticket and says absently to him, I need to get some air, and heads for a side door, leaving Jack to get her coat.
By the time Jack Traynor gets out of the building with her jacket, she's sprawled out in the back seat of a taxi, pretty out of it. He gets in, gently moving her legs, and she snuggles up next to him. He asks, where do you live? And she helpfully says, a park. Trees? And it's pretty obvious to me that she lives with the Keebler elves, but he doesn't pick up on that fact and takes her back to his place. He carries her up the stairs in a firefighter hold and explains as he goes to his apartment that his place can be pretty messy depending on if his cleaner has come. And it doesn't bother him, but apparently some of his female guests have remarked on it. He gets into his apartment, gently dumping her into a chair and offering her, a very passed out Tess, a nightcab. A nightcab. A cab to go home is what she does need, but he offers her a nightcab. Read the room, bro. He continues to talk to the passed out Tess, offering her coffee and tea, and then remarking on her passed out form, you are sure pretty. Oi. Cut to the next morning. Tess wakes up naked? Whew. No, not naked, but she's in his bed. He apparently took off her clothes, but left on all her underwear, including the garter and stockings, and then decided to sleep right next to her in his bed with his undies on. Was it his bed? Sure, but why didn't he just sleep on the couch?
Also, let's think about this for a moment. Say we were out and you'd had a bit to drink and you came back to my place and I had to help you up the stairs. You know what I wouldn't do? I would not offer you another alcoholic beverage when I flopped you onto the couch.
First of all, I don't think you could firefight carry me upstairs, Corinne. I appreciate the sentiment, but I just don't think that would be happening. Carry me up to your apartment.
No, I was thinking more of like a you stumble up with your arm over my shoulder kind of situation.
Right. Oh, I demand you carry me over the threshold like we're newly married.
Oh, okay. You're going to be waiting for a while, but, you know, I've got a pretty big doormat, so you can cuddle up on that. I'll give you a pillow and a blanket.
Yes, that's probably what's going to happen, more or less, if I'm hell-bent on that happening. Anyways, I must default to the movie that is more current, but if you want to know how to deal with an out-of-it woman that needs help going to sleep, you should watch Fever Pitch with Drew Barrymore and Jimmy Fallon, because in that movie there is a scene where she gets really gnarly food poisoning when they're supposed to go out on a date. He shows up at her door, she's puking her guts out, so he kind of like invites himself in and then proceeds to take care of her for the next day and a half. He does undress her with her consent and puts her in jammies, but then sleeps on the couch, cleans up the puke off her bathroom floor, brushes her dog's teeth after he ate the puke, and so on and so forth, and slept, as I said it before, fully clothed on her couch just in case she needed him. Uh-huh. Not, let me strip off all your clothes down to your naked bits or your underwear bits, and then let me get naked down to my underwear bits, and then let's sleep together side by side on the bed. Let's do that.
Yeah. You know, spoon, right? No.
No.
It made me totally think of the tea and consent video where there's the person passed out in the chair and is like, if you offer somebody who is like passed out a beverage, do not force them to drink said beverage.
You know why those videos exist? Because of movies like this.
Yes. 100%.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. But anywho, the next morning, Tess wakes up, looks around the room swiftly, pulls on her dress, and gets the fuck out of there. What? After getting ready, she puts herself together, her hair once again in an impressive helmet with the French twist in the back, and looks super profesh in Catherine's business clothes that she borrowed. Walking into Dewey Stone for her meeting with Jack Traynor, she mumbles under her breath, don't fuck up, don't fuck up. And when she's led into the office, she's brought into a trio of men, and one of them is, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit, it's Jack Traynor. And she realizes that it is the same guy that she had shots with last night, who woke up in his bed, and he thankfully introduces himself as if she's a stranger and points to the other couple of men in the room and introduces them as John Romano and Bernie Tarka. Jack asks her, as they all sit around the conference table, coffee? Tess answers, sure, and reflexively stands up to get it. When the woman who brought her into the room asks, milk or sugar? Tess swiftly realizes her place, says both, and swoops back into her chair. Cool, 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 cool. Tess then tells the gentleman her idea after snapping a rubber band off an accordion file folder because she lost her briefcase. She never had a briefcase. FYI, it took me a second to realize that. I'm like, oh, she doesn't have a briefcase because she's borrowing all of Catherine's clothes and doesn't have, like, actual business stuff that she needs.
Yeah.
Got it. She hands out paperwork with the information on it. John Romano doesn't like the idea, though he says, they're too high profile of a company, they have too much cash on hand, and radio stations are small potatoes. Tess calmly retorts, I've thought of that. We can get them a high profile radio station, and then with their surplus of cash, they can buy a bunch of their stock shares back up. That way, they're protected from a hostile takeover. Cut to Tess, back at her desk, freaking out about the business deal that probably didn't go through, and Sin talking her gently off the ledge. Well, it's not like they threw you out, Tess moans. It's not like they have bouncers. Oh, and last night, fuck. Sin calmly replies, yeah, next time I'll check the milligrams. But Tess is freaking out, and then across the office she sees... Who does she see? Find out with us after the break.
We're back. When we left off, Tess was in full despair mode until she sees, across the office, Jack motherfucking Traynor. What? She swiftly switches to full panic mode and begs Sin, please, be me, please. Sin isn't happy about it, but by the time Jack approaches Tess's desk, Tess is nowhere to be Sin. Nowhere to be seen, and Sin is sitting in her seat, in Tess's seat. Jack says, Jack Traynor for Tess McGill, please. Sin smiles and gets up with great aplomb. Let's give her a shout, shall we? She hooks her arm through his and leads a very confused Jack over to Tess's office.
Mm-hmm.
Sin knocks on the
door. Tess, a.k.a. Catherine's office.
Yes. Tess knocks on the door asking, "You decent?" And then popping the door open while smiling broadly at Jack. Jack approaches Tess, and Sin, who is standing in the doorway, asks, "Shall I hold all your calls, Miss McGill?" And she makes a thrilled, "You go, girl," face. Tess placidly replies, "Yes, please, Cynthia." Then Sin asks, "Can I get you something, Mr. Trainer? Coffee? Tea? Me?" And Tess laughs stiffly. "She's Orion, isn't she?" "That'll be all, Cynthia." As soon as Cynthia closes the door, Tess asks, "Why did you pretend you weren't you last night?" Jack raises an eyebrow. "I knew what would happen. It'd be all business and no tequila shots." "Aw, what a mensch."
It's like such a 20-year-old move, like, "Hey, can I buy you a drink? Double tequila shot." I'm like, okay, that's somebody who's trying to get somebody else fucked up. Mm-hmm. Not like, let's have a glass of wine or a martini even.
Right.
He's like ordering double tequila shots. Shot, 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 shots.
I'm surprised he didn't put a line of Coke down on the bar.
Right. Mm-hmm. So here's what you do. You suck the lemon, you lick the salt, you do a line of cocaine, and then you take the shot.
Woo! Put some hair on your chest. Tess says, "I woke up in my underwear. What happened?" He responds, "The earth shook. Angels wept." And when she keeps on looking him with a pissed off look, he gives, "Nothing happened. I took off your shoes, took off your dress, and kept my eyes closed the entire time. Okay, maybe I peeked, but all I did was put you to bed and then climb in half naked into bed with her."
Right.
You asshole.
Right. He just conveniently left that part.
Then he says, "Look, I don't have all day." And he thrusts the package into her hands. And I'm thinking dubiously, it's got to be a stupid large box of chocolates. But it's not. And he actually makes some points with this one. It's a swoon-worthy gift. A beautiful leather briefcase. Jack says, "I figured if we were going to be working together, you'd need a better briefcase." She smiles happily. They talk some business. And then he asks her why she chose to use his company for the deal. Her intercom buzzes. Tess quickly excuses herself, popping outside the office, only to see a very irate Ginny being blocked from entering Catherine's office by Sin. As soon as Ginny sees Tess, she says, "Bess, my computer's down and I need to use Catherine's for an important deal." Tess tells Ginny she'll be right with her and ducks back into the office. Ginny demands to Sin, "What's she doing in there?" Sin flatly says, "Dusting."
Okay, so Jack did win some brownie points for the beautiful leather briefcase gift. However, he's like minus 175 points out the door when he gets before this scene.
Yes.
So what is he up? Like up 20 for the briefcase, but still down 175. So that means that he's at 100 minus 155 at this point.
Good mathing. It's almost like you weren't a woman.
Oh my God. I can count. I don't know if you know this. But it's also like that in that day and age, that's supposed to be endearing. Like, oh my God. So he had like this naked, beautiful woman, like completely passed out and he didn't touch her that much.
Yeah.
Oh my God. What a fucking gentleman. What a knight in shining armor.
Well, seriously, if you look at it for that time period, it is like,
I know,
like he was being a complete mensch.
Right. And that's what made me like cringe, because I was like, oh, that's so true that people are like, oh, swoon.
Yeah.
Oh, he didn't fuck her. Did you see that? He totally didn't fuck her. And I'm just like, I hate to say it, but I was a heavy drinker into my, like, not heavy drinker, but I would drink.
You would party, yeah.
Copious amounts of alcohol in my teens and 20s.
Sure.
And me and a bevy of my friends would wake up the next day and be like, oh my God, what happened last night?
Right.
And so it's just so, it's a godsend that nothing bad ever happened to us, because we were all kind of looking out for each other.
Yeah.
But then just if you weren't, and you happen to take two double shots of tequila with fucking Valium and then wind up at some guy's apartment and then you wind up the next day being thankful that nothing happened to him. And that's a plus. That's, ugh.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez. You didn't get raped? Great. Oh, my God. That's an awesome start. Let me just say that.
It's very romantic, if you ask me.
I know. He totally didn't date rape you. Oh, my God.
That's a man. Well, you know Mick would. Mick would be
exactly. I thought the same thing. Mick would be all over that shit.
Yeah.
He'd be all consent. Fuck it. You in my bed. You're naked. You know, anything goes. Mm-hmm. Anything goes.
He'd be like, oh, you wore that dress to entice me. Oh, you wore that underwear to entice me. Obviously, this is meant to be.
It's your fault.
Duh.
Back in Catherine's office, Tess explains to Jack, my M1 o'clock is very impatient. Do you mind if we meet later and I walk you out to the elevators? Jack says, sure, but answer my question first. Tess's brain hamster is running on that wheel, working out when the answer finally comes to her. I wanted the best, so obviously I reached out to you. Jack likes this. Lets her know that he's getting on it tomorrow. They are partners. On the way to the elevator, he asks her out, but she rebuffs him, saying, my life is complicated, and we're going to be working together. It's better if we keep things simple between us. He gets into the elevator. I'm not asking for anything complicated. And Tess responds, oh, I know what you're asking for. And then she playfully states, maybe I just don't like you. And as the doors close, he scoffs, you don't like me? Nah.
That was kind of charming, too.
Mm-hmm. That evening, Tess arrives late to Sin's engagement party. Sin, her best friend. Sin, hey, the one that she's been in cahoots with this whole time.
Sin, the woman who showed up to her to give her moral support for going to the party and who pretended to be her receptionist and fended off fucking Ginny for her.
Okay, sure, right. But then we're going to talk about points again because she's up 25 points, and now she's going to go down 175. Because they're holding Sin's engagement party at their favorite bar, and Sin happily greets Tess, but asks her to make nice with her boyfriend/ex-boyfriend, Mick, the guy she found having sex with somebody else in her apartment, because Sin wants her party to be a party, and Mick is being pouty in the corner.
Aw, poor Mick!
Tess obliges her bestie, and I had to let me just breathe a couple times before I say this, because I was telling Corinne at the beginning of the show, I'm like, why the fuck isn't Sin going to Mick and being like, pick your face up off the floor, motherfucker. You're the one that cheated on her. You have to live with your decisions and do not fucking ruin my party by being a pouty little
pissant.
Pouty pissant in the corner, please. Mm-hmm. No. Sin goes to Tess and says, make nice with your ex-boyfriend. I don't want a scene and I want this to be a nice party. What the fuck?
Seriously. And it's not like Tess was going to go up to fucking Mick and throw a beverage in his face. She was just going to fucking avoid him.
No, ignore him. Yeah, she was going to ignore him and be like, fuck this. I don't need that asshole in my life. But then Sin's over there going, no, you go make nice. You go make nice with him because it's my party and I want you to. Sin. Oh, Sin, your sins. The sins of Sin. I can't even. Mm.
This evening just gets better. It just gets better.
Tess obliges her bestie. Hold on. Let me just scroll down past the three lines of all the stuff that I say with much, much cursing that I've already told you. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Here we go. And Mick and Tess end up chatting, slow dancing to Lady in Red, and then due to Sin's fiance and the rest of the bar egging him on, while Sin looks on in horror, the woman that Nick slept with looks on in sadness, and Tess looks on with surprise, Mick, for God knows what reason, asks Tess to marry him.
Oh, what an asshole.
Yeah, in front of everybody after he fucked around, didn't apologize. I'm sure they haven't talked about it yet. There hasn't been any kind of reconciliation. They're merely at the same place at the same time for a party, and he decides it's a good time to propose to her.
Look, they slow danced together to Lady in Red. I mean, if that doesn't say reconciliation, I don't know what does.
Oh, my sweet baby Jesus. No. So what does Tess say to this marriage proposal? She responds, maybe. and then smiles at him when he gawks back at her because she doesn't jump on the opportunity. And she tells him, "You want another answer? Ask another girl."
Yeah.
At the end of the evening, Mick and Tess are walking outside, and he tears into her for embarrassing him. Let me repeat, he tears into her for embarrassing him and demands a yes or no answer for his proposal. What the fuck is this? What is happening? Oh my God. When she tries to explain that she might be uncertain because she just saw him having sex with another woman 2 nights ago, he gets pissed. Ugh. And says, "Well, it isn't about you, isn't it? What about me? What about what I think? What about what I need?" And we must pause a moment to ask, yes, what about poor Mick and what he thinks and what he needs? And Mick storms off in a huff.
In a huff.
In a huff. And you, gentle listeners, if you would like to donate to the Poor Nick Fund, please reach out to us at ODK here. We want him to feel safe and secure in his masculinity because mm-hmm. God knows he needs it. He's such a good guy.
Who knows if he'll even be able to pick himself up after an evening like that when a woman, instead of saying outright no to him, says maybe to help him save at least a little bit of face.
A little bit of face. Yeah. God, I'm seeing stars. I'm going to have to just lean back a little bit as you go through this next section, Corinne, because I am at a complete fucking loss. At a loss.
Well, and that, I mean, the thing about it is if the maybe was an actual maybe, what he did outside of that bar just was like, he was such an asshole that it's like, no, there's no going back after that. Like, she wants to really be with him now. Ugh.
Oh, God. I mean, he said, "It's not about you. It's about me." You're right. That's why you should be in this relationship with yourself, and I'll just see myself out.
It is about you sleeping with another fucking woman.
I know. And like I said, you know, he didn't apologize. You know, he didn't try to make amends. You know, he didn't like own his shit for doing mm-hmm. that. And he was just like, "What's wrong with you? Why don't you want to marry me? Just because I was fucking another girl 2 nights ago? Why don't you get over it? That's old stuff."
It was just a misunderstanding, Tam. It's just a misunderstanding. And
right.
Here is, in this section, Sin loses a few more bestie points, sadly. Like, she's fantastic through most of this, but this hot mess of a section between the two of us right here, Sin loses points.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people lose a lot of points in a lot of places. Mick didn't start with any points.
No.
He's already in the negative.
Yeah.
Jack Traynor kind of started okay. No, never mind. Then we saw him for his true color. Yeah. Sin started off strong. Like, I'm envisioning those little like games at the carnivals where the little horses like run a little bit ahead of each horse, and you have to like squirt a water gun into their butts or something to get them to go. And like, these horses are going backwards. Like, they're getting past the finish line. The shit is going down, and I don't know what's happening.
Oh, let me tell you, Tam. Misogyny. Misogyny is happening.
I sometimes you don't realize how bad it was in the 80s until you watch Working Girl and you're like, holy fuck.
Yeah. Yeah.
Holy fuck.
Yeah.
I'm going to go lay on my fainting couch while you read this because I need a break.
Oh, I'm going to have a Cabana Boy fan you while I do this next section.
And feed me grapes.
And we'll feed you grapes. Yes. Crispy ones. Crispy, sweet, delicious grapes.
That'll match my 80s high hair. Mm-hmm. The crispy grapes match my crispy hair. Thank you very much.
The next day, Tess is in Catherine's office working on the Trask Industries deal, a.k.a. figuring out how to crash Trask's daughter's wedding tomorrow so she can bend his ear about the deal. When Sin comes in with a giant suitcase. So, bestie points for this. After her engagement party, she was nice enough to get a bunch of Tess's stuff from her apartment, and she recounts to Tess, "I was stuck there until 5 a.m. with him talking to me. He's not happy and talking about throwing out the rest of your stuff." And I'm like, oh, boo-hoo. I mean, like, I feel bad for Sin going to the apartment and having fucking Mick bend her ear for that long. But yeah, Tess gets a call from Jack and and changes her voice, and as she transfers to Tess's assistant and then back to Tess, she breathily says, "Hello." Jack lets her know that the meeting went well and that he's been working all night on the deal. We see him talking to her in a class conference room, and while he asks her out to lunch, he strips out of his shirt, dabs some conference room water under his arms, does a light little scrub-a-dub under his pits, and puts on a new shirt, much to the delight of his coworkers outside the window, who give him a round of applause and wolf whistle at him, basically. Tess agrees to meet him for lunch with Jack's assurances. "It's daylight, not romantic. Heck, we can meet at the souvlaki stand out front of your work." After she gets off the phone with him, Sin gives her the look. You know the one that says, "I know what you're up to and it's a bad idea." Sin warns Tess, "Don't you go getting involved with Jack, thinking he's going to go change everything for you. If you do, you're going to get your heart stomped, just like you're stomping on Mix." And I'm like, excuse me?
She's stomping on Mick's heart? No. He's stomping on his own heart.
Gentle listeners, Tamara has sprung up off of her fainting couch. She is irate. She has perked forward.
I've caught air because I leapt up so forcefully. He's dealing with the repercussions of his actions, and why does Sin continually keep on blaming her friend Tess?
Sin, no. She defends fucking Mick. Like, that is not... She needs to be in her fucking bestie's corner. But regardless of that, Tess has a great reason as to why she is not with Mick. Beyond the fact that he's a fucking asshole, because he just hasn't been supportive of her this entire time and raged at her when she was trying to be kind of nice to him. Oh, no. You went and cheated on her as well and probably had done that many other times than that.
I wish that Tess would say that to Sin directly. Like, mm-hmm. He was fucking somebody else in my bed 2 days ago just to hear how she would defend him, because it makes absolutely no sense, the things that she's saying. So what? He just fucked a girl. Like, they were using protection. It's fine.
Look, you know how men are. Mick talked to my fiance because he's the best man, and they just had some wine and it like fell on their clothes and they had to take it off and then they accidentally landed on each other.
Right. Over and over again, right? Yes.
Tess retorts, "It wasn't me who was sleeping with Doreen DiMucci." So she does say so. "Why are you on his side?" Ha ha. Thanks, Tess. Sin backpedals. "I'm not. It isn't like you to not give him a chance." Excuse me?
AKA, Tess, you really need to be more of a doormat than you have been. Like, seriously. What the hell? You're putting your foot down and asking for somebody to respect your boundaries and you. But that's just not you, girl.
No.
No, sit down and shut up and take it in the ass.
Mm. "If you don't stop what you're doing, you're going to be out of this job and any job. You're out of your man and your home already." And I'm like, damn, Skippy, fucking Sin should have kicked out Mick from the apartment. Tess assures Sin, "I'm going to come clean. I just need a few things set up first. I know what I'm doing." No, you don't know what you're doing, Tess. Mm. Sin retorts, "Yeah, ruining your life." Tess is tired of her life as she knows it, the status quo, and she responds, "I'm trying to make it better. I've worked my ass off and gotten nowhere playing by the rules that other people have written, so now I'm making my own." The phone rings and Tess hastily answers the phone saying, "Tess McGill's office!" But oh shit, it's Catherine. Tess assures Catherine, "No, totally your office. I don't know why I said that." Sin gets up and says softly, "See ya, Tess." Tess covers the receiver of the telephone and whispers, "Sin." And Sin approaches Tess at Catherine's desk and leans over saying, "Sometimes I sing and dance around my house in my underwear. It doesn't make me Madonna. It never will." Once Sin leaves, we focus back on Catherine, who is on the phone. And I do understand why Sin has reservations about, like, all of the hijinks that Tess is up to. Like, I get that, other than the fucking her being empowered when it comes to Mick.
Oof.
Once Sin leaves, we focus back on Catherine, who is on the phone. We see Catherine in her hospital room, but it's like a party in there. Woot, woot. She's wearing a sexy chemise, as one is wont to do. The room is filled with balloons and flowers. There's someone painting her toenails. A nurse is handing out champagne to people in the room. And there are a couple of doctors in there, probably to do lines of cocaine off of her cast. Catherine informs Tess that she's coming back in a week, much sooner than expected. Expected. Fuck.
Oh, God. My head is spinning with this movie so far. Corinne, did you label this section Wedding Crashers, just the tip?
Yes.
Okay.
Because that's what they say in the movie, Wedding Crashers.
When Tess and Jack meet for lunch, true to his word, they grab something from a food truck and walk around. He asks Tess for an update on Trask, and she doesn't have one, but assures him that she's meeting Trask tomorrow. Jack flips out, feeling like he's being excluded. He's been under a lot of pressure at work and is afraid of being replaced. He thinks Tess lacks confidence in him, so Tess invites him along to her, quote-unquote, lunch date with Trask. And where will this lunch date be? Why, we'll find out soon enough. The next day, Tess and Jack are walking to their quote-unquote lunch date, and Jack begins getting suspicious. Tess breaks the news to him that they're actually crashing Trask's daughter's wedding. Jack's not thrilled, but it's too late to back out now, and he needs a win. But there's a couple of things wrong with this little scenario. First one being, Tess is wearing white to a wedding that she's not invited to, which is a huge no-no.
Huge no-no.
Second, it's a Caribbean-themed wedding, so again, white is a weird choice. And third, they immediately run into Trask, but he's not liquored up enough, so the timing seems wrong to pitch him the meeting. So Tess, instead, leaves to the powder room to powder her nose. With face powder, not cocaine. While Jack grabs a couple of tropical drinks and downs both of them as marimba music plays in the background. Once Jack and Tess are reunited, he expresses feeling like he's a policeman who's partnered with a rogue cop who's gonna get them both killed. She starts doubting her audacious plan and says, "Maybe you're right. We should go." But Jack isn't having it. He sees Mr. Trask on the dance floor and is up for the shenanigans because he's full of liquid courage, a.k.a. drinks. He asks one bridesmaid, who's played surprisingly by Ricky Lake, Hairspray, her debut role came out the same year as this movie, and asks who the young lady is that's dancing with Trask. Ricky Lake responds, "Elizabeth," and Jack probes for a nickname and asks, "Elizabeth Betsy or Liz?" Ricky responds confused, "Bitsy." He nods and enthusiastically approaches the duo, saying, "Bitsy, please tell me you remember me. Can I have this dance?" She's confused, but also fuck it, because she's dancing with the hottie. "Yes, please." And she gladly leaves Mr. Trask for Jack's welcoming embrace. And Tess, in turn, takes the opportunity to step in Bitsy's place. As they dance, Tess smoothly tells Mr. Trask, "Small world. Here we've just met, and I feel like we've spent so much time together in a way." Trask is confused, and she explains, "I'm in mergers and acquisitions at Petty Marsh." He good-naturedly says, "Oh, I wish we were having more luck with your team." And Tess agrees, "I know. I've been trying to set you up with a radio network, but my boss thinks you're just stuck on acquiring a television network." He shakes his head, "That's not true." And Tess agrees, "That's what I said. I said a forward thinker like Trask, the man who in 1971 looked into the future and saw that it was microwave technology, adopted Japanese management principles when everyone else was dealing with the unions. This man didn't get where he was by shutting himself off to new ideas." Trask is eating this up. "You are right. If you got the right property, I'd love to hear about it." And just then, Tess sees a woman pointing to Tess and Jack, the party crashers. She realizes the jig is up and quickly wraps things up with, "I just realized I'm hugging the father of the bride. And I see Phyllis. What do you say I call you Monday?" He happily agrees while a very angry bride in a very floofy dress starts storming towards them. Jack quickly spins off Bitsy, sending her twirling off the dance floor, and approaches Tess, saying, "Honey, I'm starved." And they get the fuck out of there, saying a quick goodbye to Trask on their way out. Question about this section, because Trask is ultimately going to figure out that they were not invited to the wedding. And would he still be so inclined to meet with them, knowing that they crashed it just to meet with him? These are the questions I have.
I'm sure that he would not be inclined to meet with them, knowing that they had crashed it. But he doesn't figure that out till much later.
I don't understand that, because you see an angry mob coming towards you and you leave, and they're probably going to be like, "Daddy, you were just dancing with a girl who crashed our wedding and was wearing white."
Or maybe she went to, like, follow her out the door or something like that. I don't know.
I don't know. It just seems like she'd be the type that was like, "Daddy, that girl wasn't even invited to our wedding and you're dancing with her."
I'm surprised she's not more sympathetic, because I cut this scene, but Tess was very kind to her in the bathroom.
Right. There was also another scene cut earlier in the movie where Tess was like, "We're just going to show up to the wedding because nobody blatantly looks at you and says, 'I'm sorry, who are you?'" Like, it's just too high class an event for folks to do that. And everywhere she turned at this Trask wedding, people were like, "And how do you know the bride and groom? And who are you? And why are you here? And how are you related?" So it was kind of like a funny little, like, ah, shit moment.
Once they're out of the venue, Jack gleefully laughs and pokes fun at Tess for the way she buttered up Trask. He is delighted by her and finds her resourcefulness refreshing. They spend the weekend going over the deal and Monday head to Trask Industries. However, Trask is not at the meeting and his people are not receptive. Plus, apparently, Slade, you know Slade. Huh? Slade? Yeah, you know Slade, right?
Oh, Slade! Yes.
They've put a bid in on Metro Radio Station, and Trask Industries does not want to get in a bidding war. Tess and Jack counter, saying that Metro is very family-oriented, and Slade wasn't invited to buy it, so they're sure there's not going to be a bidding war. They can set up a meeting between Trask and Metro and the Metro Radio Magnet. The two very dour gentlemen give a firm no, and then a phone on the center of the table rings. Dour gentleman number two answers the phone and says a couple of yes sirs, and hangs up the phone. He bitterly says, "Trask will take the meeting." Tess questions, "That was Trask?" Dour gent number two says, "Yes." She asks, "How did he know?" DG2 replies flatly, "He knows everything." They get out of the meeting and immediately make out in the lobby. Let me be clear. Tess and Jack get out of the meeting and immediately make out in the lobby of Trask Industries, not with the other two dour gents. Dropping their beefcase.
Dour gent two and Jack Trainer make out in the lobby?
That would be hot. I would like that. Yes, please.
Dour gent two and Tess. Dour Gent 1 and Dour Gent 2 make out in the lobby.
Oh, okay. No? Yeah. I like that. I can go.
I'm picturing all these scenarios simultaneously. It's like a choose your own adventure. Who do you want to make out with in the lobby?
Ooh. So many choices, so little time. So Tess and Jack drop their briefcases and kiss each other passionately. Flash forward to them making out at Jack's house, stripping off their clothes, and then flash forward again to a food delivery. He hops back into bed after the delivery, and they chat warmly with each other. She's also in the bed. He then jokes about killing off his girlfriend, and she's about to tell him the truth when the phone rings. He grabs it, has a short conversation, and after he gets off the phone, he confesses that he has a girlfriend, but he's done with her. He just hasn't had the opportunity to break it off with her. Really, truly. He was supposed to go away with her last weekend, but had to work through the weekend, so he never got there. And I'm like, fucker, you don't go on a vacation with someone to break up with them. You break up with them before the vacation. He continues as he kisses Tess's back. She broke her leg skiing, and I couldn't see doing it over the phone. I would have said something sooner, but she works in your department. Tess's eyes flash open, and she says, "Catherine." He acknowledges this and then asks, "So, what did you want to tell me?" She says, "That I'm maybe engaged to an asshole named Mick?" She doesn't say that. She instead says, "Nothing. because this has all gotten way more incestuous than she ever expected. Also, I don't think Catherine was getting that proposal she was hoping for.
And next we are cueing Tess, paying about $300 in today's money to pick up the dry cleaning of all the clothes of Catherine's that she wore, and then in turn vacuuming her house in her underwear, as one is wont to do, and clearing her shit out of Catherine's house because she's on her way home! Ultimately, Tess goes to the helipad to pick up a very high and happy on muscle relaxers for the trip, Catherine. Tess is tasked with schlepping a giant stuffed gorilla, a gift from one of her many admirers, and several pieces of luggage for her. In the car, Catherine uses a car phone to call Jack, flirtatiously insisting that he come over in an hour, and no, silly, I will not take no for an answer. Once Tess arrives at Catherine's house, her boss gleefully swings around on crutches and goes over to her computer while Tess deals with the luggage. Catherine turns it on and pulls up a screen asking Tess, "Did you see this? I realize that it might look like I was trying to steal your idea, but I just wanted Jack to see it first because he was previously burned on a deal where it ended up being somebody else's ideas. I just want you to know that I'm still fighting for you."
Mm-hmm.
She smiles brightly at Tess, and my sneaky detector is going off. She continues looking directly at Tess and continues, "But who am I kidding? If you'd seen something, you simply would have asked me." Her eyes drill into Tess as she states, "Trust." She starts crutching into another room and says in a sing-song voice, "I'm going to need help bathing and changing." While Tess drills daggers into the back of Catherine's head with her eyes. Because fuck you, Catherine.
Like, oh yeah, that's why I told you that the deal was a no-go. They were only doing TV.
Right.
Lies.
And she's doing so much backpedaling and just expecting Tess to swallow the bullshit pill that she's feeding her. Oh, I still value your ideas. You keep them coming, but this one's mine, bitch.
Mm-hmm.
Tess ultimately gets Catherine set up on her bed, freshly bathed in a silk chemise with a cream-colored afghan over her cast and freshly sprayed with Shalimar perfume. Jack's favorite. Tess tries to get the fuck out of there before Jack arrives, but Catherine insists that she pick up her medication first before she goes. Tess crosses the street for the drugstore as Jack pulls up in a taxi and they just miss each other. Jack goes up to Catherine's apartment and she immediately comes on to him, hot and heavy. He dodges her advances, explaining that he needs to go. And she bargains with him, saying, "Come on, just have some champagne with me to celebrate my return." He reluctantly agrees, goes to the next room, finds the bar's mini fridge, and grabs a bottle, just as Tess returns with the medication. She hears a champagne cork and ducks into an adjacent room and cracks the door to watch Jack fend off Catherine's initially flirtatious advances, which ultimately turn into a marriage proposal, the proposition of having babies together, and then when that still doesn't endear him, she gets way more aggressive and literally tries to take his pants off. He tells her, "There's someone else," and Catherine's face falls until he adds, "I have a meeting with," and he gets the fuck out of there. Tess quietly repositions herself in the hall and acts like she knows nothing, gives Catherine her medication, and dashes out the door. But she's left behind her planner. Catherine yells after her, "Tess, you forgot your..." But the front door closes. So Catherine does what anyone would in her bored and rejected state. She snoops through Tess's planner and then sees that Tess has a meeting with Trask Industries and is pissed, shouting, "That little slut!" and throws Tess's planner across the room. "That little bitch secretary!"
Suddenly, someone can get themselves dressed. Huh, go figure.
Wow, it's just, one of those quick recoveries, those miraculous quick recoveries.
Mm-hmm. The next section is entitled, "Things Get Spicy."
You mean they weren't spicy already?
That was just the tip. Now things are really spicy.
Oh, just the tip. Okay. But just the spicy tip. Yeah, ouch.
But not in a sexy way. Tess arrives at Trask Industries, has a hushed conversation with Jack while they are waiting for a decision to come about of whether Trask will buy the radio station. Tess asks Jack, "If I came to you with someone else's idea, would you hear me out?" Jack says, sure, I hear other people's ideas all the time. Tess clarifies, would there be an ethics problem like stealing? Jack is confused. I look at stuff all the time and no one's accused me of stealing. And Tess knows at this moment with crystal clear clarity that Catherine is a lying liar pants. But now, the question is, will Tess's secrets all catch up to her? Tess expresses that she's nervous and Jack whispers, you'll be fine. He pauses a beat and then says while staring intently at her, I love you. She says, I know. Sorry, Star Wars joke. Couldn't help myself. She says, staring intently back at him, I love you too. The sexual tension between them is palpable, but they are smart enough not to make out with each other at this meeting. Finally, everyone is called to meet and they sit at a giant round table, 11 men and Tess. The radio station decided to sell to Trask, and Trask is very happy, crediting Tess and Jack for helping them to see and execute this plan. Suddenly, there is a kerfuffle from the other room, and Catherine comes storming in full business gear in spite of an assistant's best efforts to keep her out. She gestures emphatically with one of her crutches, pointing it accusingly at Tess. Thank God I'm here. You're all being tricked. My name is Catherine Parker, and I'm an associate partner at Petty and Marsh, and that woman is my secretary, and she stole my idea by rifling through my desk while I was laid up in the hospital with broken bones. Jack looks over at Tess. You're not a secretary. Tess confesses, it's true. I'm a secretary, but she stole my idea. The room is rumbling full of what the fuck, and Catherine, who knows how to work a room, does a dramatic half faint, getting herself a seat at the table and a glass of water. And now that Catherine is sitting at the table, she takes over the motherfucking meeting, stating, thank goodness I'm here to take charge and straighten this all out. Trask is pissed, understandably, and Tess looks beseechingly at Jack, saying tearily, I know you don't believe it, but it doesn't matter, I'm sorry. She turns to the rest of the table, saying, sorry. Sorry, over and over as she exits the room. Once she leaves, Jack clears his throat and says, gentlemen, the players may have changed, but the game remains the same, and the name of the game is Let's Make a Deal. If you'll turn to page 22 of the prospectus, you'll see the terms of the transfer. He glares at Catherine across the table, and she looks surprised at his response, or shook, or no.
We move on to happier times. Sin gets married and Tess must be the maid of honor because she gets a flouncy seafoam green dress versus the hot pink bridesmaid dresses the other women are wearing. As Sin and her newly minted hub drive off in their car, Tess stands off to the side and has a short conversation with her ex. She tells him he looks good in his powder blue ruffle front tux, even though nobody looks good in those, but apparently she's a good liar. And he updates her on how his life and how well he's doing. Until Doreen, the girl that he was fucking in their bed, enthusiastically bounces up on Mick with a bouquet in her hand. Tess then sees how everything is going to play out in regards to that. Tess, you dodged a big bullet on that one. They go their own merry ways, and I am actually happy for Tess that she's just like, fucking done with that.
Yes. I'm glad that that door closed. I was like, oh, thank you, Doreen. I mean, sorry, Doreen, that you're stuck with Mick, but Tess.
I mean, Doreen, you made your bed. You're going to have to lie in it because she's the one that was like, well, never mind. It's not even worth discussing.
Well, we haven't talked about it at all, so, you know.
Well, not with her, not specific to her. She was just the one that accidentally fell on his dick over and over and over and over again. Tess is unemployed and reading the paper on the ferry back to New York City to her old job to gather up her personal belongings. I swear to God, when I saw this scene and she's wearing like some jeans and a like sweatshirt and she has her hair down and her hair is not helmeted up, I did not recognize that that was her. I was like, why are they panning on this woman on the ferry that, oh, it's Tess. Oh, shit. Oh, anyways, She's going to her old job to gather her personal belongings. She sets down the paper and gets up from her seat, starts exiting the boat, but then suddenly dashes back to the paper and tears out the inspiration page. She's got an idea. She arrives to her ex-job and starts cleaning out her desk as her secretary co-workers gather round. They're sad that she got sacked and took up a collection for her. One says, "It's not much, just enough for you to get toasted one night when you really need it." Tess leaves with her box, but on the ground floor she sees Jack and Catherine coming through the turnstile. She quickly turns to walk away, but accidentally thwacks into a guy and drops her shit, spilling its contents all over the floor. She quickly tries to scoop everything up until Jack kneels down to help her. He says, "I've been looking for you all over." And Tess sighs, "Just leave me alone." He looks at her intently. "One thing, was you and me part of the scheme too?" Tess looks up at him cheerily and angrily says, "No, if I told you I was a secretary, you never would have listened to me. Maybe you would have pretended to listen by taking me out for drinks and trying to sleep with me, but that's it."
Mm-hmm.
Jack's eyes soften. "That's not true." But Tess doesn't believe him. And by that point, Catherine has made her way up to Tess and says, "Stealing more stuff from the office?" Tess replies, "No, this is my stuff." And Catherine digs in, "Your stuff? That's a broad term." Tess firmly states, "No, my stuff. You may be able to fool everyone else with this act you have going on, but don't ever speak to me again. Like we don't know what really happened. Take your bony ass out of here and get out of my sight." As Tess is confronting her, Mr. Trask and his cohorts approach from behind. Tess continues, turning to Jack, "And if you think I told you I loved you as a manipulation, that's really pathetic."
"Yeah."
Trask says, "Is this how you do business?" And Catherine responds, "I'm so sorry you had to see this. No, no, no. It isn't. Let's go upstairs and finish this deal." They all pile into the elevator except Jack, who remains standing outside. He addresses Trask. "I'm sorry. I'm not going in unless Tess is part of the deal. This was her deal from the beginning, and she's the best person to lead it."
Aww.
Trask scoffs. "Don't let your dick make your decisions for you." But Jack refutes this. "I'm not. I'm telling you, she's your man." But Trask isn't buying it. He inquires, "And what brings you to this conclusion?" Jack says firmly, "She said so, and I believe her." Trask shakes his head. "That's not good enough. Are you with us or not?" And Jack, much to all of our surprise, holds firm. "No," as the elevator door starts to close. Tess gets some of her oomph back and bounces up to the door, saying, "Ask her to tell you about the hole in the deal."
Uh-huh.
The doors pop back open, and Trask asks, "What hole?" And Catherine says, "There's no hole. She's just trying to make a last-minute play for control." Tess thrusts the piece of paper she had torn from the paper on her ride into the city. It's from the People section, and Catherine isn't impressed. It talks about how Slim Slicker is moving to the Big Apple. Catherine rolls her eyes at this. "So?" And Jack says, "Slim Slicker is one of Metro Radio's major assets. He's syndicated, the cornerstone of their programming, and number one in his slot." Tess states, "You lose him and Metro's just okay. Real estate with failing ratings, and you weren't intending on buying this as a write-off." Jack states, "You better make sure he's locked in before you sign anything." Catherine brushes it all off. "Don't worry, I've got this covered." She hits the button to close the door, and at the last minute, Trask slips out, leaving Catherine trapped in an elevator going up.
I had no idea he was so spry, but he is.
And he's very spry.
Yes. Tess, Jack, and Trask all get into a different elevator. Not all three of them getting into three separate elevators. They all get into a different elevator together. And Tess pulls out her Trask file with her inspiration pages, detailing the process of how she got to the idea of the deal, showing paper clippings that corroborate what she's saying. They get to the floor first because there's only three people in the elevator while the other elevator was packed with people. And when Catherine gets off the elevator, Trask asks her, "So, what inspired you to put Metro and Trask together?" Catherine does not have an answer. She asks Jack for help. Good one. And goes on the defensive. "Are you accusing me of being anything but the most ethical?" Trask raises his eyebrows and says to her, "I suggest you have one last look around your office, because I'm going to personally see to it that it's the last time you're in it." He turns to Tess and says, "What did you call her?" And Tess and Jack say together, "Bony ass." Trask states to Catherine, "Now get your bony ass out of my sight." Catherine haughtily says, I will not stand here and be treated like this. And she stalks off to her office. Trask asks Tess, why didn't you say anything at our initial meeting? Tess says, well, you wouldn't have listened to me then. And unless you're higher up, you can't bend the rules. And if you're like me, you can't get higher up without bending the rules. Trask admires her gumption and offers her a job, entry level, starting tomorrow. She accepts, and Trask and crew head back out to go to the Trask offices to look at Slim What's-His-Name's contract. The secretaries, who are all out on the main floor and have been witnessing the whole exchange since they came upstairs, all have their pocket popcorn out. Jack and Tess stand in front of the elevators and kiss, much to the delight of the secretaries, who are all friends with Tess, and they clap and go, aww, just like I'm clapping and going, aww, as I watch it as well, because he gains a lot of points by, like, standing up for her at the elevator, just saying it's all.
Mm-hmm. It's the next morning, and Tess has spent the night at Jack's. He has very cutely packed her a lunch of PB&J with Twinkies, lunch money, an apple for the teacher, and it looks like a couple of giant celery stalks into a black lunchbox. He tells her to play nice with the other kids and to make sure she's home before dark. Hopefully it's summer, and do they live together now? Is that what's happening?
I think that they insta-moved in together, kind of like you and Larry.
Sha-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Ta-ta. Tess goes to her first day at Trask Industries and starts sitting up in her cube. Her new boss, is sitting in her office talking on the phone with her feet propped up on the desk. When she finishes, she comes out and apologizes to Tess. Sorry, I was just talking on the phone. Tess smiles affably and says, well, that happens. Her boss, asks her, would you like some coffee? And Tess says, yes, just tell me where it is. Her boss, says, oh, no, I'll get it. And before she goes, she says, and by the way, that's my desk. Tess is confused. I thought the secretary sits out here. And the girl she thinks is her boss says, yeah, I'm your secretary, but I prefer assistant. That's your office. She points to an enclosed office with a window, thank you very much, across the aisle from her. Tess takes a moment to process this while her assistant gives her the rundown on the meetings Tess has for that day. Tess lets her assistant know that she thought that the office was her assistant's, and her assistant apologizes and says, maybe now's a good time for you to tell me what your expectations are of me. Tess pauses a beat and says, well, call me Tess, and I never expect you to get me coffee unless you're getting it for yourself, and the rest we'll figure out as we go. Her assistant looks happy and smiles and says, okay, I'll be right outside if you need anything. Tess's first call is to her bestie, Sin. Guess where I am? And let the river flow. Let all the dreamers... Go ahead, Corinne. Sing it. Sing it. Sing us out.
Let the river run. Let all the dreamers wake the nation.
Surges in the background as we see Sin in the middle of her office floor excitedly announcing to all her fellow secretaries that somebody finally made it out. And they all raise their hands and cheer Tess's accomplishment.
Whoa.
The end. Holy fucking bollocks. La-la-la-la-la-la-la. Corinne, how many dry kisses do you give Working Girl?
More than you. No, I give it 4 dry kisses. It is not diverse at all, but it has a good women empowerment action to it. And as a young one, that Carly Simon song, I was like, yeah, I'm going to go and conquer the world. So I have to give it 4 dry kisses. What about you, Miss Tamara?
Good Lord, no. Oh, I think I don't, again, have that gooey soft spot for this movie like you did, because I did not watch it when I was younger. So watching it last week for the first time, I was just full of, what the fuck? First of all, makes me realize how far we've come from the 80s. Even though we're not where we need to be, I was just cringing so many times, reliving all kinds of bad memories, having flashbacks, twitching in the corner. Not really super enjoying a lot of parts, because I'm like, that just... But, oh, God, the groping and the misogyny and the oh, my God. Read. But anyways, also, I've seen Melanie Griffith in things, and I think she's not this role. She was kind of flat in it, and that's probably like her claim to fame, but it really did not allow me to understand what the fuck was going on. So I told Corinne, I'm like, oh, you're happy. Oh, you're sad. Oh, you're really passionate about this. But I couldn't tell because she was kind of like one tone. Mm-hmm. She was beige. She was beige in the movie and didn't really have a lot of inflections or changes in her persona. So I was kind of lost. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying she's a bad actress. I'm just saying like this movie with her in it didn't really work for me. Mm-hmm. Jack Traynor also like supposed to be endearing because he didn't date rape that woman when she was passed out in his apartment. And that just like painted him in a bad light for me. Cause I was like, he's supposed to be like endearing. And the guy that everyone's like, oh my God, what a catch. And I'm like, he just literally crawled into bed with her. So this movie was not my favorite. I did not enjoy it as much as you, and I'm going to have to give it 2.5 dry kisses.
It is probably my favorite Melanie Griffith movie.
Oh, okay. That's fine. Oh. Like I said, she's the 80s Kardashian.
Oh!
She's just...
So on that note, Miss Tamara, what movie are we covering next week?
We are covering Mystic Pizza, the movie with the worst soundtrack in the whole world, but also the best hair on Julia Roberts, even for the 80s.
I don't remember the soundtrack. I do remember watching it and loving the movie back in the day. Very interested to see how it plays out now.
Lots of saxophones. Lots and lots of saxophones.
Oh no.
No, not Shania's. Saxophones.
If you have anything you'd like to say to us about saxophones, whether you thought that Melanie Griffith was underrated or overrated in Working Girl, Carly Simon's Let the River Flow. You can reach out to us via email at onedrykiss@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us on the social medias, Instagram, Twitter, X, and Facebook, all at One Dry Kiss.
That's one spelled O-N-E. And as always, if you haven't already, you, I'm talking to you right there, are you? You hear me? You hear me now? If you have not given us a rating or review, that's fine. We completely understand life's busy, things happen, but we could really use your ratings and reviews if you can find the time. But we absolutely 1000% thank you for stopping by and hanging with us as we went over Working Girl. I hope you're on the Tamara fence for the dry kiss ratings, but you may fully be on the Corinne fence with the 4 dry kisses. Again, thank you for stopping by, and we bid you adieu with one dry kiss. See you next time.
See you next time.
Let the river run, let all the dreamers wake the nation, come the new Jerusalem.
You better bring the same energy to your singing as that, Corinne. That was dance moves and everything. Jesus Christ, I was feeling it. I almost put a lighter in the air.